Normally, I have a pre-episode, pre-recording discussion with my guests to talk about what it is that we're going to focus on, what topic, area, element we might want to focus on and explore further based on their experiences and the work that they do. This week's guest, Simon Wilhouse, has thrown me a bit of a curveball because when we connected to record, he mentioned that he's actually moving on to a new role in a new organization. So we sort of decided to scrap our conversation and the topic that we were going to discuss, even though we did touch upon it later on, just a spoiler alert. And boy, I'm glad we did, because it turned out to be a very fascinating discussion that focused on Simon's new role, that the one that he's going into, and challenges, exciting challenges that it presents, and opportunities for development, not only for the organization, for the teams and everything, but most of all for Simon himself. We also look back at Simon's previous role and the initiatives he ran in the organization to improve so many different things, from employee pay to diversity and inclusion. We talked about the concept of wholeness, accepting people as they are, and what does that actually mean? How do we make it something that it's more than just a poster on a wall in a corridor that you walk past every single day? Simon started his career in the arts, training as a professional dancer. From there, he went on to work in arts facilitation, where he gained a love of learning and development. Having worked in HR strategy and partnership for a number of years, he moved into the charity sector. He is a passionate advocate of LGBTQ plus rights, diversity, equity, and inclusion in the workplace. He believes in ethical and innovative people functions that care for and support workforces to be the best that they can be, personally and professionally. Here's my conversation with Simon Wilhouse. Enjoy. We Got This showcases individuals and organizations that create people-focused workplace cultures to help it become the norm rather than the exception. It's something that will require a mindset shift, and probably not something that any of us can do alone. But together, we got this.
I only tendered my resignation this morning.
Let's do it this way. Let's just have a chat. If an episode comes out of it, fantastic. Yeah. If not, we just leave things as they are. But I'm curious to find out what's the new role? Where are you going? If you can.
So, of course. I'm going to be the head of people and culture for St. Martin in the Fields. I don't know if you know what that is.
I'm assuming it's a charity.
It's charity is one of the things. So St. Martin in the Fields is a church, a big Church of England church just off Trafalgar Square in the centre of London. But as part of that church, there is also a charity, specifically a homeless charity. There is also a commercial company that sits underneath the umbrella, an arts company that really focuses on musical excellence, a retail company, and a hospitality company, all of which feed into the wider outreach work that the organization does. They have a very prominent gay vicar, female gay vicar. So there's a lot of LGBTQ outreach that wraps into the work that they do alongside the homeless charity, and that all feeds into the concert stuff, which is what's the money-making arm of the business, if you like, that feeds the rest of the charitable outreach work. So it's a really interesting company who were somewhat affected quite dramatically through COVID. So it's a brand new role that's been created, and it's really focused on culturally aligning the five different companies and bringing those under the sort of the one St. Martin's vision and rebuilding those companies to sort of take it to the next level. St. Martin's as an organization has global reach, not just through the church, but through the charitable work and the other things that it does. And as a center for excellence around music, there's a homeless choir. It has links with Trinity College of Music and other things. So there's lots of concerts that happen there as well. As well as having an English-speaking congregation, there's also a Mandarin-speaking congregation and lots of others. So this sort of interplay between the faith element of the church and the charitable values and morals of the charity arms and the music arms, they all sort of have this really beautiful interplay between them. It's quite unique. I've not really come across a company quite like it before.
Wow. Well, first of all, congratulations again. It does sound like a task and a half to merge all of these different organizations, units, I don't even know how to describe them, companies in their own right, communities in their own right, really, for the employees. That sounds like a really exciting challenge, to say the least, isn't it?
I am incredibly excited by it. Yeah, I'm not underestimating the size of the task at hand, that's for sure. But everybody that I've met so far, from the clergy to the board to the CEO of the charity and CEO of the wider organization, they're all aligned. They're all passionate about what they do. And they really want to make St. Martin sort of a destination of choice and to really push forwards with all of the charitable work and the reach of the church, and to sort of spread a really inclusive message of solidarity. Reverend Sam Wells, apart from beautifully gifted orator, that's very inspiring to listen to. His whole philosophy around faith is about finding people on the edge. And that aligns quite nicely, I think, to my philosophy around working with people from a HR perspective, and really acknowledging the fact that all people have lived experience. All employees come into organizations with all sorts of things, and life happens to all of us all of the time. And that the ethics that sits behind how they treat people that they want to bring into the congregation really sits quite nicely along the way that I want to work with people within an organization to support growth and nurturing and development and sort of psychological and safety within the workplace. So for me, I suppose the task is finding all of those golden threads that already exist within all of these different companies and then sort of tying them together into a cultural strategy to move forwards.
I'm actually struggling to put it into words how exciting does this sound for me, and I'm not going into the role. That's the funny thing. But what I like about that is, in a way, you already have the big piece that many organizations don't have, or at least they have it on paper, but it just doesn't stick. And that's the purpose, the alignment around a goal or a mission or whatever, however you want to define it, whatever that is for the organization. And that's, you know the direction you're heading in. It's now just figuring out the way, I'm guessing, of consolidating that. And do I understand it correctly that this is more about, as you used the word efficiencies and how all of these organizations and companies, groups work together, rather than actually coming in and transforming the way the world, transforming the culture of the organization?
I think it's both. The board were very clear that there is a cultural transformation that they want to take place. I think there are really strong and founded individual cultures that already exist. My job will be to align the common threads through each of those cultures to bring them into what? Well, firstly, to establish what the St. Martin's culture is and what those core values and mission statements are, because each of the different companies have a slightly different take on what that looks like and how that works. Each of them are slightly further along in terms of policy or practice or embedded people systems, etc. So there's quite a lot of foundational work to do at very core level to get those purpose statements and value statements codified between people. And then we'll use that as a baseline to work, through a co-produced model with different subsets of staff, because it's obviously going to be incredibly important to bring everybody on the journey with us and look at the mechanisms for how we achieve that.
I can't help but think that this sounds, in a way, what in a corporate, typical corporate world, we would call a merger, an acquisition situation, where you've got different companies, one buying one, the other merging there. And then you've got, although there might, the difference here is obviously not the sector is one, the sectors is one thing. But the other thing is that you are sort of, as I said, aligned. It needs a bit of aligning, making sure that everything is up to scratch, but at least it's the same similar direction. Whereas in the corporate world, you have two completely separate companies, two completely different cultures. And it, when they merge, it's one of the things that often happens. It's a time of turmoil for several years, actually. It's underestimated how long it takes. Many people think it's a question of a couple of months and things like that after things are finalized. And for things to be finalized, that takes a while. But then for it, truly culture to merge, even when working at it actively, that takes years. And very easy for something to happen is obviously the us versus them mentality. And that is probably the number one problem that mergers and acquisitions deal with is that, because it's unaddressed and leaders don't really know how to handle that. But when you do say that it's different companies and different entities there, it does make me think of that corporate environment. I wonder how different that actually is or will be for you in reality to manage that.
I think it's probably quite an astute observation, and notwithstanding that I haven't started the job yet, there's quite a lot for me to learn and get underneath from there. And, you know, the first 90 days probably be me spending a lot of time in one-on-one and small group meetings to get to the crux of that and to get underneath people's individual perceptions and experiences within their subsets of the organization, to try and unravel and unpick all of that, because they will be a mixture of those people. There'll be people that have been there for a long time who are quite happy in the way things have always been done, and there'll be new people with fresh ideas. But there at least appears on the ground, and certainly from a top level down, to be a real appetite and willingness to grow and push and merge and work together, and certainly a great amount of collegiate respect between all of the people that I've met. And they have an amazing platform. It's in one of the most prominent locations in the world. They've got huge global visibility, not just from the church, but from the charitable work and the names of some of the people that have worked there and their, you know, back catalogue of achievements. So they've got all of the ace cards in their hands. It's just a case of, you know, playing the winning combination at this point. So that makes it quite exciting.
So it's like a jigsaw. A certain stage of being put together, and it's just missing. Well, it's not missing the pieces. It's got the right pieces. It's just assembling them in the right order, right way. The one thing that you mentioned earlier around your attitude to how you build teams and how you approach the people and culture function of organizations, and how it is in the new role and new environment where you're going into, about looking thing at people that, you know, everybody's got experiences. Everybody's got been through stuff that impacts the way they are, the way they interact with other people, the way they work. And possibly I'm drawing the connection here mostly because I'm reading this book at this very moment, and that is Reinventing Organizations. And it's a fantastic book. I'm literally about a quarter into it, but it talks about different organizations, different stages of development, I guess, of an organization, you can say. And it introduces this concept of teal organizations, because it's color coded. And teal are the organizations that we're building now, or we're building in the future. And it got a few elements to it, and one of the two most important ones is being able to self-manage, for people to be able to self-manage themselves. But the other one is wholeness. So looking at people through that lens of everybody's individual, everybody's got their experiences, and that makes them a whole person. That's what they bring. And the new organizations that we will be building, that we're building now, and we will hopefully will be building in the future, focusing on that, that it embraces the person, that they can bring themselves as a whole, entire unit, whatever that is, to work and be themselves, right? Rather than hiding. I really like the term of doing a second job. And basically the second job is hiding. You go into work and you hide. You're something that you might not know, for example, that you don't know how to do something. You don't know how to ask for help, and you're basically hiding. You've got the imposter syndrome or whatever that is. And we spend so much energy that if employers think about it from that perspective, and that's kind of the biggest job that's actually useful for the employer, to help their employees to do that. Because if you've got somebody, and I'm sure majority of people do the second job to a greater, smaller extent, that is, they're basically doing a second job on the job. So the employer is getting half of the potential of the person that they're employing, what they're paying for. So they're not getting a great deal here. So it's in their interest to help people develop and accept them as they are, and help them through whatever process they are. That's just kind of on a not necessarily a side note, but in relation to what you were saying. Have you by any chance heard of or read Reinventing Organizations?
I haven't, but it sounds really interesting. And I'm particularly interested in the concept of bringing your whole self to work and what that looks like in different contexts, specifically thinking about, so for example, LGBTQ+ representation. Again, people who identify within that community, there is a broad spectrum of people and how they present themselves physically. You might be gender non-conforming, you might be slightly more atypically camp, you might be slightly more atypically conservatively presenting. But there are historical insecurities, I think, about people who present as other to the mainstream, turning up for work as their whole selves or their true selves because of fear of reprisals or being seen in a certain way or being seen as less than or othered. So for me, it's really important within a workplace to create that psychological safety so people can turn up as their whole selves, however that might be presenting, because then that removes those psychological walls that go up every day in that second job you were just referring to about having to hide a certain part of themselves or think twice before they say a particular sentence or use a particular phraseology or, you know, colloquialism in the way that they would engage with different colleagues or clients or service users whilst they were at work. So that's a big cultural piece for me within organizations. As you know, how do we create that level of psychological safety? And as an organization, pretty much every organization in the world will say, we're a really inclusive and diverse employer and we welcome everybody. Well, do you? How do you do that? Do you say it on a job advert and put it on your website? What does that look like from a lived experience perspective? So that's a really interesting piece for me.
That is definitely a good point about what that means as a lived value, because mission, purpose, values in general, I often treat them as posters on the wall. Unfortunately, many organizations, that's only what they are. And you're right that they put it in a job advert, but what does it mean when that person joins the organization? Even before then, what does it mean in the recruitment process? What does it mean during the interview? You know, what does that look and feel like to everyone involved? People, let's not forget the people who are recruiting. You know, what position does put them in? Despite their best intentions, if the organization is inherently biased or doesn't have that psychological safety, it's going to impact the people recruiting. The person being interviewed, therefore, will get that energy. They will have to resonate with that. Well, maybe not resonate, but they will have to interact with that. And obviously, they're going to feel that. It's going to impact how they perform on a more subconscious level, whether they realize what's coming, the vibes that are coming through. So it's actually a very, very fascinating topic from that point of view and how to tackle it. Because I think, and this is my big beef that I've got with a lot of organizations, is that we've got a purpose. This is our mission. Okay, but what does that mean? What does that look in real life? And there are more PR spins and buzzwords. And it's frustrating. I know that some organizations do it with the right intentions, that they set that as a goal, that's something they want to strive for, and with the hope that they will reach that. When they set that goal, you know, they've got something to work towards. Great attitude. What often happens, though, is no action follows with that. And that's the problem, because they don't know how. So rather than making that, you know, this is our mission, this is who we are, it's like, no, this is what you're striving for. Just give yourself that benefit of the doubt that, you know, that you're still working on this. You haven't got to figure it out. I don't think many organizations do. And sadly, I think there's still a very, very long way ahead of us. Probably a generation, maybe, just a pun, that it will before this actually sets in, that we are in the moment where you and I and people around us are creating this, not for now, but mostly for 15, 20 years down the line, hopefully sooner.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully sooner. And I'd like to see these things having an impact. And I think colleagues like us who are in a position to make some actionable changes, you know, in the near to immediate future, whilst they may have small ripples now, they'll have bigger ripples later. But I do think there are some practical, easy things that people can do. So for example, if you're putting a recruitment pack together or you're sending an invite to an interview out, put in a statement that says, we encourage you to present yourself as you are comfortable doing so. Rather than just a statement to say, we welcome applications from a diverse range of, you know, applicants, or, you know, or we'll guarantee to interview all disabled applicants who meet the essential job criteria. Those things are great and they should be there, and, you know, they've taken us forward. But I think we can go further in terms of representation. There's an old phrase that if you can see it, you can be it. So I think when organizations are looking at graphics, when they're looking at what's presented on their websites or in those recruitment packs, it is really important to have, you know, diversity in those things, to show trans employees, to show people of color, to show underrepresented or marginalized employees that you might have. And if you don't have those types of employees, make sure there is something in those pack to say that those people are welcome. So you are really encouraging and living those values of diversity. Look at your board and your corporate governance structure. You know, what do the people sat around that table look like? You know, are they truly representative of the community or the society in which that organization is based? And also, does that live and show the values of the organization that you want to create? And if it doesn't, there are tools and there are people out there that can help with that.
Absolutely. And I think this is where organizations, again, that want to do something about it, they've assuming best intentions. They just go about it slightly the wrong way, because what often any initiative is, well, let's pick the one that we know of inclusion and diversity, is like, they've identified a number of points they want to address and they address it all at the same time. No, hardly any organization has the resources to be able to do that. And even the ones that do have that, it's a mammoth task, because it's such a sensitive topic in any way you look at it. So it's about picking the most important things, the most important element. I don't know, is it to increase the gender balance because there's bias towards one another for no reason? Or is it to do with LGBTQ communities or racial, anything really? Just pick one that is most important, one that you can address now that aligns with the values, aligns with what the organization is trying to do. What's important to the organization? What's important to the individuals? What does that mean? And again, don't turn it into a PR exercise. Because for me, the more I hear an organization talking about how much they are doing, the more cynical I become. And this is probably my wrong and my bias here, but it just, for me, that's flashing out. Saying, okay, are you just talking about? Because I do like the people in the organizations who could just get on with things. They do things and show results rather than say, this is what we're doing, this is what we'll be doing, and things like that. Because sometimes I think it's more for, as PR, as I said, and more for external validation. Just show, this is what we're doing. So they make themselves feel better. And again, this is my cynical side coming out drastically here.
I think you're right to be cynical. There are a lot of organizations like that. I mean, to use my current organization, WDP, as an example, we've just completed a huge review of pay benefits and rewards package. And we started that by speaking to our staff, all of them, and by giving them multiple ways of engaging with us, because we knew that if you're giving a town hall speech, only a certain number of people are going to raise their hands within that forum. If you go into a team meeting, the dynamics and the political context in there, only a certain number of people are going to want to engage. So we did the town hall, we did the anonymous feedback forms, we did an email inbox that people could request one-to-one meetings, we did the team meetings, we did mail outs and newsletters to make sure that we were getting the message out, but more importantly, so people could engage with us in a way that felt safe for them to engage with the conversation. And that was very much the foundations of the co-produced model that we were going through with this, because we wanted to hear from our staff what they needed, what they wanted, but also to give them power and autonomy in the process so they could share it with us and be part of the ride. Demographically, just looking at our organization, we're about 65% female, 35% male, and then maybe 1%, if you like. So one of the main things that came up throughout these conversations was that, you know, we've got a workforce of a large number of 30 to 50 year old women. One of the main things that are affecting that particular demographic is peri and menopause, perimenopause and menopause. And we didn't have a pre-existing policy around that. So we put a task and finish group together. We worked with women across the organization, and people who identify as women, to put together support mechanisms and actionable support that we could have across the organization, and guidance for managers who may be male or other identifying, to say, you know, cracking a window, for example, is important. Is there enough ventilation? Could you work with your colleagues that may be suffering symptoms of menopause and perimenopause to be a little bit more flexible? Home working, hospital appointments, other adjustments. Can we move desks around? You know, those sorts of really practical things that just make the day-to-day lives of these people easier to run. And then we had further conversations around what are things that matter to our employees and how do they align with our core values as an organization and as a recovery-focused organization. So we put in place things like a day off for your first child's or for your child's first day at school, for example, because a paid time off, that is. because it's important to live those family values and to give people the time back to enjoy those experiences, because they only come around once for people. We put things in place like bereavement leave for a beloved pet that died. You can have a day off, you know, should you lose them, because they're part of the family. These are emotional times for people. Cynicism to the side, we did put a section in the policy that said we expect managers and staff to use their discretion, and perhaps a goldfish isn't quite the same as a beloved cat or dog, for example. But, you know, it's about giving that trust and ownership back to staff, and, you know, trusting them to be adults and professionals at the end of the day, and showing that there is that collegiality between the two. And then there are some other sort of slightly more buzzy topics that we looked at, but nevertheless, they're important. So we've got domestic abuse leave, IVF leave, miscarriage leave. We gender neutralized all of our family friendly policies around maternity, paternity, adoption, etc., to make sure that however you present or identify, that there's an equity of provision there for our staff, because A, they align to our values, but they're also important to people. And it gives people the freedom and the confidence to know that A, we're a caring employer, but also that we will support them as much as we possibly can as an employer. And of course, there are boundaries within what an employer can do. But to have a good personal life and then therefore enjoy their professional life, and also gender transition leave, where we've got provisions for those things too. So alongside all of that, we also put in an additional week's worth of annual leave to take into account that, you know, working within health and social care for the last 18 months has been hard work for all of our practitioners. You know, they're tired, and we wanted to recognize that by making sure that they had the well-being time that they could use at their discretion to go and get a haircut or a manicure, or just take a day off, or just stay in bed, or go for a walk, whatever it is that people needed to do for themselves, that they had the time to do that. And they didn't need to feel guilty about it. They didn't need to worry about pay for those things too. But the thing that I'm really happy that we were able to do was a huge benchmarking exercise over salaries. There's been a long history of salaries for frontline health and social care workers, or care workers in general, being quite underpaid across a national picture. So we were able to do a significant amount of benchmarking and really put a pay offer on the table that was sort of really sector challenging in a lot of ways. You know, we also increased our occupational sick pay to beat most of the other competitors in the arena. Now, whilst we did that with a focus on supporting our staff and making sure that we were doing the best we possibly could as an employer by all of those staff, the secondary impact of that is it has an impact on the wider community and the wider sector, because of the nature of the sector. Tenders are won and lost on a competitive basis. So there's a lot of 2P that takes place within our sector. And obviously with 2P comes the transfer of terms and conditions. So if one employer is offering much more attractive terms and conditions, and eventually all of the other players in the sector start having to take notice. So it's really nice for a relatively small charity like WVP to be able to put something in place that has a really meaningful impact, not just for our employers, but hopefully sort of starts a ripple in the ocean across the wider community too.
That's a lot of initiatives. It's a lot of initiative in the span of how many months? I'm guessing, is it all through the pandemic or...?
In a busy year. So since they've almost exactly 12 months.
Wow, that is a hell of a lot. And by the way, they all sound really, really amazing. All the stuff that in a way makes me think, why do we even have to do this? Why isn't this like this the gold standard, the thing that we just take for granted that this is the accepted thing? And hopefully this is what we will have at one point in the future. Because a lot of the things that you were saying strike me as the element of self-management for teams and organizations, that about taking time off and needing time off to go and see your little ones first day at school, whatever else it might be. Just all of a sudden you need a day off and not having to run or feel like you have to run and beg for it because it's last minute to get that. No, you just organize, you let your team know, listen, this is the stuff that needs to be done. I won't be able to do it tomorrow. I'll pick it up on Thursday. In the meantime, you can do this X, Y, Z. Is everything okay? Do you need me to do anything before I go? Communicating with the team and everybody knows what's going on. Happy days, everybody can move on. Work can continue. Whereas now we do have still that the need that we need to make things policy. In a way, the word policy makes me cringe because it's so formal, but this is also what we need. And I guess the beauty of that is that it gives people that permission, right? it's a policy, we can do that. Great. This is probably a way of moving things forward, I guess, that can help us to get to that point where we're teams, organizations are self-managed, because we were at that point, at that shift, because the pandemic has done many different things in the world and it's impacted organizations in multiple ways as well. And a bit of an earthquake in terms of how people approach work, what they want from work was expected. And now there will be a demand from potential employees from organizations to be able to deliver that. And it's like, oh, no, I don't want that because I want flexible working. It's important to me. If the organization doesn't offer it, I'm going to take my bag and I'm going to go somewhere else. So the organizations are going to have to catch up with that. And this is, I think, this is not just around flexible working. Everything, all the initiatives that you've mentioned, I think it will be something that your organization will have to do. Yeah, we need to do that now. So hopefully 2, 5, 10, 20 years down the line, this is not going to be policy. This is just going to be how things are done.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more. And there are, thankfully, some debates going on in Parliament at the moment around flexible working and what the rights should be. And we've stolen a march on that as well. So we've removed all of the service accruals and the waiting period. So flexible working application with us is a day one right. Life happens all of the time and every day. You shouldn't have to wait 26 weeks to put in a flexible working application. You can do that on day one. Same with maternity pay, for example. Nobody knows when that's happened. Sometimes it's planned, sometimes it's not. You don't have to wait 26 weeks or to be, you know, eligible for our enhanced maternity pay either. That is there to support people because those family values are important to who we are as an organization. And quite frankly, I think it's important from a retention perspective. If I'm going to look at it from a HRE point of view, you take care of people, people take care of you. That is how it goes. It's the reciprocity of life. And organizations, I think, could learn a little bit from those really fundamentally human values and by treating people a little bit more like family. A lot of companies say, you know, we're a family or we're a community. Well, speak to people like their family then. Look at the language that your organization is using. Is it really officious? Is it really strict? How do you structure your emails? You know, do you speak to people with a commonality of vernacular that engenders that sort of familial relationships? And if you do, great. And if you don't, maybe you could try that a little bit more and maybe those interpersonal relationships get better. And maybe those little niggly people management issues that crop up all of the time don't happen so much. You know, it's the little things.
Definitely the little things. It's an interesting thing that you mentioned about family and the different levels. It's something that obviously we're talking about based in our reality, UK, US, for example. I'm originally from Poland. That's where I was born. That's where I was raised. And in Poland, the custom is that if you don't know a person and if they seem to be older than you or even the same age where you don't know them, you address them with Mr. or Mrs. So it's Mr. Simon or Mr. Wheelhouse or whatever it might be. And that is, for me, having lived in the UK for over 13 years, in Poland, it's a shock to the system because I'm just so not used to it. Because if for me, it's a massive barrier to connecting with people that you build. And a lot of people say this is a mark of respect. And I get that to people who are older than me. So for example, the previous generation, my parents' generation and generations above, I kind of get that's a mark of respect. Absolutely. But in certain situations, I just don't get. For me, it's an artificial setup that we've created, artificial respect that we create. It's got nothing to do with respect. We just do it because we do it. We actually just do it. And actually, very often, it's very visible when people are angry with one another. The Mr. and Mrs. is stressed when it's pronounced. To me, that's just an indicator that Mr. Wheelhouse. It's that, oh, trouble, right?
In science class again. Every time
exactly. It just goes back. And often you don't use it when you talk. And when it appears when somebody's angry, you know that's coming up. And for me, and I find it very annoying. Actually, I make it a rule that I, to the shock and awe of some of my friends, the people around me, I tend to go first name basis, but in a respectful manner. And very, very quickly follow that up by saying, I hope you don't mind me doing that, and of course feel free to do the same towards me. I don't expect to be called Mr. Guzowski, Mr. Lek, or whatever. I don't want that. For me, it's artificial. And that's a cultural difference in different countries that you also have to contend. You don't necessarily have that in the UK, but again, if you've got EU or Polish employees, maybe, they might find a little bit odd. That builds a barrier between communicating, relating to people, because they're used to it. Poland is still very much a culture of corporate, because there's a lot of corporations and very, very kind of strict, that type of work. The work that we're talking about with you here now, it is in Poland already. It's great, but it still has a fair bit to catch up, I think.
I think that's really interesting. And the point you make about non-Western or non-British cultures is really interesting, especially with companies that have a global outreach or a global presence. The culture bit really comes into play there, because you need somebody that understands fundamentally the cultures of the people that you're doing business with, where you're doing business with them, so you don't fall into those sort of social faux pas of either forgetting to address somebody appropriately or showing the due levels of respect, whether that might be in Asia or Poland or Eastern or Western Europe. So I think that's definitely quite interesting. And to a large degree, that then distills down within organizations here. I mean, just within WDP, there are multiple people of multiple ethnicities and origins from all over the place. And they will be bringing their own cultural journeys into their own positions within the wider culture of the particular setting they're in, within the wider culture of the organization that they're in. So getting underneath all of that, having all of those conversations is important. And for me, that's where it comes back to sort of the devolved leadership model, and can people see what leadership looks like within an organization? Can they see what the culture looks like? Is it lived? Is it shown? Myself as a senior leader, am I living and am I sharing those values every day? Am I communicating with people the way I'm preaching about communicating with them? Or sometimes when I'm super busy, am I just replying to an email with a one-word answer? And is that appropriate just because I've got 6 million other things to do? And actually, can I take the time and can I put the first sentence in that email to say, hi, it's really nice to hear from you. I hope your children are doing really well. I heard one of them did something lovely last week, for example. Not that I'm suggesting that I know everybody in the organization on an intimate level, but just that I think we can all be a little bit more mindful. I think we can all take one step back, and I think we can all just say, actually, maybe I can just be a little bit more familiar with people to encourage those conversations on a more human level. And maybe I'm not as busy as maybe I think I am. So we can take that time for people.
In relation to what you said, something that I really like is the example of that. I actually don't know where I've got it. It will come back to me at one point, but it's basically about asking people how they are, or asking somebody how they're doing, and actually caring about the answer.
Yeah.
Rather than it being a flyby, hi, how are you doing, when you don't even stop when you walk past somebody's desk and just throw it there. That, to me, there's a mark of a good leader. And you don't have to be not a leader in a sense that I've got people reporting to me. You can be a team leader, project manager, product manager. You don't have people reporting to you, but you're part of spearheading that team in whatever shape or form that is. There's two books that I would really recommend to you. Reinventing Organizations, the one that I mentioned already. Fascinating book. Even though I'm already only a quarter in, I can sense it's a great book. And the other one that I've read and reread, highlighted, re-highlighted numerous times, it's called An Everyone Culture. And An Everyone Culture is about three organizations that are being looked at from a perspective of them being a DDO, a deliberately developmental organization that focuses around developing people, doing everything they can to develop people. And even one of those organizations, because they do that, and the book looks at it, how they do that. So one organization, they used to have a rule, and I think they still have that. The company's called NextJump. They have a rule that no one can be let go for performance-related reasons. So you can leave the job, whatever, yes, but if you're struggling, if you're not performing, the organization looks at it from a perspective, okay, we failed. What can we do better to support you? It's our failing that you're not performing as well as you could. Have we put you in the wrong role? Have we misunderstood your skills, your experience, where you fit in? Did we offer you the right training to be able to do your job? And I think they're in some sort of technology in interactive agency thing. I think they used to be e-commerce. So it's an IT business type of thing. And they're big, the American company, but the other two are American as well. The one is, I think it's Bridgewater? The investment firm, and by Ray Dalio. And the other one is a cinema chain. Fascinating read. Definitely, definitely worth for you and anyone else, really.
I will check those out. I do like a good book. I've just started John Amici's book on on leadership, which is really interesting from his perspective. I'm only about a chapter in, so I won't evangelize too much about the main points in his book. But he's a fascinating individual with quite a unique perspective.
Definitely. I do like a good book. Reinventing Organizations has been on my reading list for a couple of years, easily. I don't know why I've never gone around to it. But recently I thought, I think it's the time, and definitely is. It's one of those books that I had to be ready to read. It was just waiting for that time. And I think that time's come.
Yeah. I'm currently halfway through studying for my MBA. So the reading list is vast and long. But there are some really interesting people. So, I mean, there's quite a lot of older literature from people like Perutis on strategy and practice and those sorts of things. But some slightly more contemporary writers, people like Amina Ribara, right? Her book is, get this right, Act Like a Leader, Think Like a Leader. And there's some really interesting points that she makes in those books around hubs and bridges within organizations, you know. So, you know, does information travel from A to B and back from B to A, et cetera? Or do you have hubs where, you know, information is, you know, like a basketball game, it's constantly being passed around, you know, between people, and there's this holistic knowledge exchange, and, you know, how do you go about facilitating those kind of cross permeations of communications within an organization? So there's some really simple sort of pictographic ideas that are really well laid out in her book. So I'd recommend anybody sort of new to leadership or looking at organizational design, or perhaps as a communication issue within organizations, to sort of check out those ideas, because they find them very useful.
I'm really keen to see what's going to come out in terms of textbooks and resources from the last 2 years. What's going to come out of this? You know, when we look back in 15, 20 years time, what we've learned, what have we put into text? Because I think in terms of theories on leadership and culture and everything else, does it reinforce everything that people have been preaching for the last 15, 20 years? Or will it actually create more of a demise of that? I don't know. It's interesting. I've got a feeling it will reinforce most of the points, but you never know.
I don't know. No, I think there's going to be some really interesting stuff coming out, because I think the world is learning that those pre-existing company structures are not as fundamental to the success of companies as people think they are. I mean, I'm talking to you now from my living room. Our CEO lives in Devon. We're a London-based company. Our finance director lives in Belfast. I've got team members up and down the country. Like, you can run a business remotely perfectly well. You can manage company culture without necessarily having everybody in the same room. There is ways and means of doing a lot of these things. So I think the idea of possibility and the reinforcement that change is possible and rapid change is possible and successfully possible will be coming out of a number of these things. Not for everyone, you know, not in every sector, but I think if there's one thing that we've learned, is that adaptability isn't necessarily something that everybody has to intrinsically learn before it can happen. People will adapt because they have to.
Mm. Just so there's not a misunderstanding between us, by reinforcing principles, I meant things like David LaRue's Reinventing Organizations, what they've been preaching for the last 10, 15 years. Because what you said, absolutely, it makes me really angry when I see organizations who have just been literally waiting for the ability to tell people, okay, it's done. Everybody back to the office. No. Why? What for? What's the benefit of that? This is to use the classic debate of flexible working, which to me is should no longer be a debate, as you mentioned. You get it from at WDP, you get it from day one. And as you should. Why is that? That's one of my biggest bugbears about when I was an employee, is I didn't understand. Why did I have to be in the office? I really didn't. And especially what aggravated me the most was the fact that I was an office worker when needed, and I was a field worker when needed, because I was a marketing manager and I was spending a lot of time in and around the UK. So when it suits, but not when it suits me, right? But the argument for the organization is like, yep, always happy to go away for 2 days, 3 days, a week, whenever, travel up the country up and down. More than happy. But then if I want to do that, you know what, this week I'm working from home. Why? Because I was working remotely for the past week, when I was in London, when I was in Edinburgh, when I was in Manchester. And that was fine. I wasn't in the office, and lo and behold, the office survived without me. And there was only six people who everybody had the little patch they looked after. So I don't think it's a debate. I don't think it's something that we should be even talking about anymore. But nonetheless, it remains to be seen how psychological safety and culture building, remote flexible settings, how that will pan out. And the organizations who had that tie and still have that tight-fisted control need in them for people, how will they fare going forward? I think over time they will change, it will crumble, because people will demand, people will vote with what they want and whether they want to work for that organization or not. But time will tell.
Nicely. I think for me, and I've already started to see it with office spaces like WeWork, for example, the conversation and the dialogue now happening around, well, what is head office? What do we need head office to be? What does that facilitate that? Because it's not necessarily the core running of the business. So what else do our employees need from that space? Is it a communal space? Is it flexible meeting space? So there's that cross collaboration with people that can come and physically meet up. Is it social space? So people can build that community and those familial relationships with other colleagues across the organization within the confines of work. Is it L&D facilitation space? Is it training space? Is it, you know, in any number of these different things? Or is it just recreational space within a work context that's, again, reinforcing these relationships, or just flexible working space so people can come and work on a beanbag if they want? Why not? It's comfortable for some. So many people have back issues at work. I mean, how many of us HR professionals have processed, you know, access to work applications or occupational health referrals because you just can't find a chair that suits everybody? Well, then get creative about the type of furniture and seating they have around. Some people might like to work on a sofa. Some people might like to work on a beanbag. Some people might want that desk or those little meeting pots. So create a space that is as flexible as the hybrid arrangements that your company have shown that they're perfectly capable of achieving. And create that space for your employees to engage with other employees in a way that suits them. Because all that's going to do is reinforce how happy they are to work there, how much information exchange that happens between these people, how much innovation that happens between these people, because you're generating these conversations in new and interesting and relaxed atmospheres. All of that is to the benefit of the organization. So I say we do away with the old guard and the desks and the operator chairs, and we adapt some slightly more modern thinking.
Interesting that you say that, because recently I was at a request about whether I know any interior designers / architects who specialize, who would be able to take on the task of redesigning an office to facilitate, and I love how specific they were, to facilitate creativity, to create spaces for people to mingle and bump into each other and have spaces, opportunities to talk and do all sorts of things. And it was like, I absolutely love that. And it made me think, so what does that mean? I know when somebody comes into the office 2 days a week, because they're in a hybrid model, what does that mean? Do we need desks? Do we need office? Do we need offices? Do we need meeting spaces? Do we need meeting rooms? What does that mean? And how do we create these natural interaction points where people can, you know, have these conversations rather than being stuck at desk in silos and things like that? So it's an interesting direction that we're heading. And I hope I get asked that question more. Speaking of questions, and the normal questions I usually start off with is the question that I guess we might could finish off with. And that is, you do what you do. You're head of people and culture, and you're going into a new role. But I'm curious, is that what you wanted to do when you were little? Or is that there was this something else that was your dream?
I'm not sure if you asked any HR professional what they wanted to be when they were little, that they would tell you it was to work in HR. Not that I don't love my job, which I do. No, I wanted to be, well, many different things. I wanted to be an Olympian when I was younger, and I trained as a gymnast. I even won a couple of medals. And then I wanted to be an artist and an interior decorator. So I studied art and textiles and photography and fine art. And then I trained as a professional dancer at a conservatoire in Southeast London. So there were many iterations of what could have been a career before I found my way to where I am now. But I think the thread that permeates all of those was creativity. And I fundamentally always liked puzzles and helping people. And through each one of those different avenues, whether it was through, you know, artistic interaction or performance or engaging with, you know, community practices or learning and development or working with kids, not in education or training as I did previously, or now in HR, it's always been about what I can give back to people and communities. And as an othered individual that grew up gay within, you know, a small town in the West Midlands, something that's very close to my heart is anyone that is othered or marginalized or not represented, which is why I'm such an advocate for these kinds of policies and processes in work to make sure people can really be and live their best experiences, you know, within a workplace.
I see another thread there in what you wanted to be and what you are now and what informs most of all what it is that, you know, you've mentioned a lot of things, what informs, you know, your day-to-day decisions and what you're involved in that. But I also sense the element of wholeness in that as well, because you mentioned being a dancer, being in a gymnast. To me, those are things where you really have to be in touch with your body, your inside, well, what it is to you, because obviously the dancing, you've got the rhythm, gymnastics, you have to have awareness of what's going on, spatial awareness, hand eye coordination, all of that. To me, looking at as a, you know, as a big picture as a whole, that's something that I personally would see that a connection between that and what it is that, you know, and as you said, that's what is important to you.
That's really fascinating. No one's ever said that before. But yeah, I think there is something about that. I'm very much an all-in, jump in the deep end person. I mean, if I suppose under Belbin, you'd call me a completer finisher, or Myers-Briggs would call me, you know, ENTJ. I'm very much, if something needs doing and something needs fixing, I am there until it gets done. And I enjoy that, you know, whatever it is. And if it's a 1,000-piece jigsaw piece puzzle at Christmas, I'm also sitting at that dining room table and so every one of those pieces is there. So yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
I make it always a challenge to make that connection and to address the other thing that you said, that not many HR professionals dreamed of being HR professionals when they were little. There's very often a strong connection. Not necessarily, yes, I want to be a HR manager, I want to be head of people or whatever. But as simple as I want to work with people, I want to help people. And that manifests itself. I want to be I want to have a certain role. The classic ones, obviously, are policemen, firemen, which is, you know, has that service element to it. I want to serve others, serve people, help people. But a lot of the times there are finer examples that indicate when you were little that's what you might want to do when you grow up. And kind of there's that natural connection that I see. I always make it a challenge. You made it a lot easier for me, actually more difficult, because you've made a lot of connections. I'm going to go, oh, I'm going to clutch at straws here. But the one about the wholeness and gymnast and dancing, although I'm not a gymnast, I'm not a dancer, I'm very much into physical activity and body movement and just being physically active. That for me, it's so, so important. And that, I think that's why I kind of drew that connection straight away there.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. We run, you know, mindfulness sessions and physical sessions with our staff, also remotely, can be done a couple of times a week. But that physical movement is so important to my personal mental health, but also to mindfulness practice and, you know, in general. I still take a dance class every Friday evening at 6 o'clock. It is my catharsis. It is my church. It is where I go to physically move through everything that's happened in that week, to exhale, to sweat, and there is a joy to movement. I would encourage everybody to take a dance class. They will be better for it physically, spiritually, and mentally, and it doesn't matter how good you might think or not you are. Just physically moving your body in a way that it doesn't normally move is a joyful experience.
That makes me stand by what I said earlier even more about the connection between dance and gymnast and the wholeness, and that's as a driving force, as that thread, definitely, because that does speak to that does resonate with it massively. Listen, it's been an absolute joy having this very much different conversation to what we intended, but I think nonetheless it was very informative, very enjoyable for sure for me, and I'm sure for the listeners as well. So thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome, Nick. It's been an absolute pleasure to meet you and to chat with you today. So thank you very much.
It's me again. Just one more thing before you take off. Head over to human.pm/we-got-this. That's all one word, where you can find this and previous episodes' show notes, suggest a guest or topic, ask a question, or join the community of other listeners. Until next time.